What's the name of this again? Weathering. Did we kind of threw that around. Has it stuck a couple weeks later?
I've been thinking about it a lot as like a verb, like to be weathered and to weather and all of the different versions of it that we have talked about and
I
explored.
kind of like weathered now that you've just thrown that out, like got milk, you know?
Get weathered.
Yeah.
I like get weathered.
Yeah. That once we have once we break more than five listeners, we can rent a billboard, get
Yeah.
weathered. Yep. But it's like weather apostrophe D.
Where are we going to put that?
Somewhere along one of those forgotten interstates. It'll be because our budget will be limited.
Yeah, the like closed section of I-40.
Yeah,
Yeah.
near Tonopah, Nevada.
But you can get a really big one out there.
$400, 6 weeks.
Anyway, weathering, welcome back, everyone. We haven't released any of these yet. We want to make sure that we can do a couple of them. And it hasn't been easy. We have our schedules are challenging to navigate. But anyway, I think should we start with our favorite segment, our intro warm-up segment?
Let's do it.
The weather report.
Is that what it is? Yeah, sure.
I think we should. I'm excited to share my weather report because I had to Google what was happening. So, truly, the weather report in the Mid-Atlantic has been that there's like a ton of rain. And I think we're almost out of the drought that we've been in for like 3 years or something, probably even longer. But that's probably the thing that's like actually the weather report. But what I experienced last night was so crazy. After dinner, my boyfriend and I have been going out to play tennis.
Oh, nice.
Not well. I have no business picking up a tennis racket, but I love tennis. That's not relevant. What's relevant is at sunset, we were walking out and the sun was like this giant orange orb in the sky.
Oh, yeah.
And the only time I'd ever seen that before was like with wildfire smoke. So I kind of thought that's what was happening. Then I Googled it. There is wildfire smoke. But I also have been reading about this incredible, like, desert sand plume coming over the Atlantic from the Sahara Desert that I think is about to hit the south. And I was wondering if that was also,
Whoa.
yeah, Marshall, it looks like it's going to come up over Tennessee.
Oh
Like,
no.
yeah. So get ready for the sand plume. But that wasn't orbing the sun.
I'm probably mis remembering, but I think in one of the books I read recently, Isaac Storm, which I've talked about, it's like about a hurricane in the early 20th century hitting Galveston. But I think there was a part about them like realizing that really early in meteorological science that the flow of air was moving that direction and coming all the way over because of the travel of those like desert sand plumes. That was like one of the clues. I'm probably like injecting something that like sounds good to me, and it's not factual, but there was something about that in that book that I remember. And so that's crazy to hear that it's like actually happening right now.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be this week that it like all week. But I'm so curious. I don't think it's going to make it all the way up to Maryland, but I'm so curious what it's going to look like and feel like because I've been in like sandstorms in like Nevada, and I think it's going to be different. But you'll have to report
It's
out on
got to
it.
be in the like upper atmosphere, like high
Yeah.
altitudes, right?
That
I wonder
would
if we'll be
make
able to
where does
see
it
it on
land?
satellites. Some of
Well,
those
yeah.
geostationary satellites, we might be able to see it visibly. That would be really interesting to watch for.
Well, there's also the Sentinel 3, right? That does specifically like particulate imaging. Like that's right? Something about that. I remember Sentinel 3 has some product around upper atmosphere aerosols and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, cool. It's hot here in Nashville. I think it's like kind of the first taste of summer where when you have a child, you start to be like, is it too hot to go outside for more than, 30 minutes? But the more interesting part of my report is the fireflies, the lightning bugs are everywhere in my neighborhood. And I remember them growing up here. We didn't really have them in Massachusetts. From what I remember, maybe like here and there, but here I live near a huge meadow and a golf course, and I walk over there at twilight, and it's just like a rave, like a little lightning bug rave in the field. It's pretty great, and the owls hooting, it's great.
That's amazing.
It really is one of the more like magical human experiences to look out over a field of fireflies going. It's just, yeah, it's really cool.
But their numbers are not doing well. Fireflies are at risk, which there's a lot of like citizen science going on with fireflies, and my mother is out there every night counting the space between flashes. It's actually
Wow.
incredible. Yeah.
Wow.
That's great. Over here up in Syracuse, we are, or down, depending on where you are, we are getting a lot of rain, like Marta said. It's to the point that it's actually like the talk of the town, but particularly we've had a lot of nice weekdays. They just have all the rain has been so consistent on the weekends that people are talking about like what did everybody in Syracuse do to like deserve this? Like there's an article in the local paper about there have been no weekends yet in 2025 without rain on the weekend specifically. And everybody's like, what is going on? It hasn't even been that cold lately. It's actually been warm. It's just rain, rain, rain on, but on the weekend specifically. So we'll see.
What about our now that we're slightly warmed up, what about our secondary warm-up segment?
What have y'all been reading?
Want to go first, Marshall? I have a loose idea about how I'm going to segue from my book into our paper.
Yeah. Well, maybe can I just like mention that high-level subject of the paper?
Definitely do
Okay.
it.
So the paper that we're covering today is testing the limit of atmospheric predictability with a machine learning weather model. So hot topic, lots of great discussion going on right now about this paper. It's a really fun one because it's kind of focused on the chaotic system and not just like we made a more accurate forecast. It's like kind of philosophical too, which I like. So my recommendation is a book that I've been reading for a long time. If you thought it took me a while to get through Monkey Wrench Gang, Gödel Escherbach is a real kicker. It's a chunky book and it's very dense. It's this blending together. Actually, I mean, the author calls it an eternal golden braid. And it's going between mathematics and music and art and just like how those three things can relate. It's the book that coined the term strange loop around sentience and intelligence. And that's what that was the name of one of the best conferences in computer science for many years. It ended recently. But the reason I'm talking about that because it does have a lot of these themes around chaos and predictability. And one of the funny anecdotes I remember is there's the author makes a prediction of what it would take for an AI to beat a human at chess. And it was written in 1979, so I guess he didn't know what was coming. But the prediction was that AI would have to possess such a high level of general intelligence that it would decline your suggestion to play chess and suggest that you discuss poetry instead, which I love. You know, less than 20 years later, you know, easy to beat the best, the world's best chess player with computation. And then the goalpost shifted to the game of Go, which is a great documentary about DeepMind. And that brings us full circle because the paper is all about DeepMind's GraphCast. So the question is, at what point do our weather models become so sophisticated that when you say, hey, give me a 30-day forecast, they say, let's talk about the fireflies. How are the fireflies doing today? Only time will tell.
Yep. What you really need to know is that tonight, down around the corner behind that stub substation in the grasses, it's going to be some good fireflies.
Yeah. Alden, what are you reading?
I've been reading this book called Immeasurable Weather. The subtitle is something about settler colonialism and America's weather science and enterprise. And it's all about the history of white people in America and the weather monitoring systems that they set up and the interplays that has to do with colonialism and our, you know, expansion across the United States. And it's definitely an uncomfortable book to read at times, but really interesting history. Feels important for folks in our world to understand that piece of at least where we came from.
And there's probably still a lot of that that's relevant, you know, in this country, of course, but internationally as people like, actually we'll get to this in the book maybe, or the paper, just to tie it back. There's a line about that references how we have worse initial conditions in certain regions of the world. And so I think just to tie that to the paper, I think like as we think about improving those initial conditions, I think having kind of that historical perspective of maybe how we went about it in the past as humanity, right, in a way that maybe was damaging, how do we do that now in a way that is more cooperative or thoughtful or inclusive or like less, you know, imperialist, for example. So I think that will be, we could talk about that in the paper.
Yeah, it's definitely got me thinking about like what are we going to be looking, what are folks going to be looking back at the work that we're doing right now and what are their critiques going to be? Because I imagine it's almost certain that there are things beyond what you were just describing, Marshall, that we're doing right now and not being cognizant of it enough.
Yeah, I feel like that's such an important engine to have in your work that you do, no matter what you do, like thinking about how this will be understood or perceived by future generations and both considering that, but you know, also not letting it paralyze you because we can't know the future. But I'm really excited to see like what themes kind of continue to come out of our conversations because I've already seen like so many like emergent themes just from the few conversations that we've had. And I do think like equity around information access or inequity, I should say, I think is one of the things that I've seen a lot with weather and is relevant to my book, which is, I actually have it here because I'm so excited about it. It's by, I think, one of my favorite authors and probably one of the most important West Virginia authors, Anne Pancake. It's called Strange as This Weather Has Been. It's a novel that takes place in the 1970s, or 1980s, I think, during the height of a coal boom when mountaintop removal was just ravaging the landscape and ravaging a landscape where people have lived so literally deeply in the landscape for generations. So changing like how horizons look. And there's something really interesting throughout the book. And I'll say too, like the catalyst for the story is this giant flood that happens. And essentially one of the like dams from one of the mining operations, like way up in the mountains, breaks. It's a little bit uncertain what exactly happens. That's part of the story, is these people that live here that don't have all the information, very intentionally so, trying to figure out what's going on in the world around them. So it kind of reads like this post-apocalyptic, like climate fiction novel. Yeah. So there's this refrain throughout this book of the characters like looking around and just saying like, this weather is so crazy. This weather is so strange. Weather is so important in what's happening because it's causing these floods. So of course is the change of the landscape and the mining operation. But not once through this entire book that's like 300 something pages, is there any mention of like a weather forecast. There's no mention of like looking forward. And the only sort of like forecasting that you get is on this individual level of like thinking 30 minutes, an hour in advance, seeing the sky change and then understanding the weather is going to come. And I think it would be very easy to say that that's like maybe an oversight of the author, but I have like the utmost respect in Anne Pancake because she's from West Virginia and she's so deep in these stories. And there's so much research behind this book. Like it's all based on real events, which only makes it more tragic. But I think what's fascinating is that, yeah, there's no mention of a weather forecast, but in the 80s, weather forecasts were obviously available, though they were pretty much like considered useless beyond 7 days. And then when you contextualize that, like in Appalachian culture, which is like tends to be pretty suspicious of like outside information and new technology, and not because they're backward or like particularly conservative and you know, or regressive, I should say, but very much reactionary to like things that have happened with outside information and new technology that has come into the region. So I think there's just like a very deep mistrust of weather forecasting in this area. And that's to me doing a little bit of literary analysis of like wondering why there is no mention of a forecast. You have people like watching TV and reading books in the book. And so, yeah, I kind of looked up that like general timeline of accuracy around weather forecasts and horizons. And like this, I think, brings us to the paper that I think since the 80s, it's gone from 7 days to 14 days out, like how accurately we can foresee weather that's coming. And the paper is saying that it could be up to even past 30 days, which is mind-blowing to me. And while reading this book and after reading this book, I think about how important that advancement could be for areas like this. But yeah.
That's great. I do think that's that I while you were describing that book, I ordered it. Yeah. So should we dive into the paper?
Let's do it.
Okay. It's another heavy hitter from the University of Washington. So good job, y'all. That institution seems to be doing some great work. I think the theme here, like I mentioned at the very beginning, is around chaos, and not necessarily like, I think you could look at this paper through the lens of just, can we make accurate forecasts further out? But I think I love the framing of the limits of predictability. And I have a bunch of like interesting history that I think kind of sets the stage really well, if y'all will permit me, and then we can maybe dive into the abstract.
I would love a history lesson.
Okay. This is like not a lesson maybe, but some anecdotes. Anecdotes to set the stage. So in the mid 19th century, there was someone named Admiral Robert Fitzroy, who was a British naval officer and the captain of Darwin's HMS Beagle. So like, you know, a lot of in the, you know, that multiverse of people on Darwin's ship, he was there. And this person established a lot of the first daily weather forecasts and storm warnings, but faced constant ridicule for inaccuracy, which took such a personal toll. It's actually quite tragic that Fitzroy died by suicide, citing the acute stress of predicting the weather. So, you know, I think it kind of illustrates this unforgiving, and especially then, like, folks thought that weather forecasting was just impossible, right? Like, not possible. But there were people like Fitzroy who, you know, tried beyond doubt of, there must be something we can do here. And, but it was apparently very stressful. Okay, jump to the early, like the beginning, the turn of the 20th century, 1903. And you have Poincaré, I think that's maybe how you pronounce it, Henri Poincaré, a philosopher, has a book called The Idea of Chaos. And it was this predates chaos theory. It predates the butterfly effect, which we'll get to. Mathematician, philosopher, it describes the fundamental limit of prediction. And this crossover really gets me. He's the person who coined the three-body problem. That's how I know about him, which is how challenging it could be in mathematics to model three celestial bodies orbiting one another. And that was kind of a lot of his mathematics was around celestial bodies and orbits and like how that chaos was impossible to model. But he has a really good quote. It may happen that small differences in the initial conditions produce very great ones in the final phenomena. A small error in the former will produce an enormous error in the latter. Prediction becomes impossible, and we have the fortuitous phenomenon. And I had to dig that up on the Internet Archive on like this ratty scanned PDF. But, you know, you can take that to apply directly in what we're talking about here. You know, I think he was talking mostly about chaos in those mathematical equations. But if you take it to meteorology, you leap to what the paper references, which is Lorenz, which has been kind of like this, it's on a pedestal, right? Lorenz says that, you know, a butterfly flapping its wings over here may make a tornado, a hurricane that lands in the US, right? And that's where we get maybe the butterfly effect from. Although Ray Bradbury had some fiction with a butterfly flapping its wings and causing all sorts of ramifications, or someone stepping on a butterfly. Do y'all remember? Have you read that? I know, Alden, you like Ray Bradbury.
Yeah, but I'm actually not sure which one it is.
I think it's, hold on, I looked this up to remind myself. A Sound of Thunder, 1952.
I'm not even read that.
It's good. It's about a time traveling hunter who accidentally steps on a butterfly and like changes everything. So that happened before Lorenz wrote this paper in 69. So who knows who coined the term, you know, where butterfly effect really came from. But I love that we're talking 1903. Someone says, yo, initial conditions, specifically small changes in those may make the end result completely different. And maybe that means that a system is unpredictable, which is pretty great.
Although we should note, like the paper notes, it actually, Lorenz gets all the credit usually. Actually, it was somebody named Charney 3 years earlier in 1966, not 69. But Lorenz, I think, pushed the math farther forward. And when there's this classic picture of a model that with different orbiting bodies going around and around and around.
Yeah.
And whether they're going to like stay in this circle or start going over to this one and go between them.
Right, that's actually, isn't that like the dynamical, like that's one of the.
Yeah, we were I don't think we have a logo for dynamical yet, but no, for a little while that was in the running of a simplified version of that being a logo for the dynamical.org.
Yeah. Okay. So that was my fun little history. Should we read some of the highlights of the abstract to give folks a sense of what the heck we're talking about?
Yeah. I think we should start with the first sentence. That's great. Atmospheric predictability research has long held that the limit of skillful deterministic weather forecasts is about 14 days. Marshall gave the history of how we got to that point. Then, We challenge this limit by optimizing forecast initial conditions using gradient-based techniques, and then they run from there. But I think that that gets to the core of it. There has been this long-held belief that there is this limit, and this paper challenges that limit in a cool way.
Yeah, I also, you know, initially when I read this, I was a little confused by part of it. They talk about, they specifically, the paper really uses GraphCast as the core. So they say forecasts using GraphCast optimal initial conditions in the Pangu weather model achieved a 21% error reduction. And I underlined that. I was like, what does this mean? Why would you do this? But that's actually a really interesting part of the paper, of trying to kind of separate out, like isolate the variables, so to speak, by introducing another model that's learning from the, is it the correct term to say those initial, we're back propagating the to the initial conditions to make them optimal? Is that the right word? I don't know.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. So that was a really interesting piece that I want to talk about. It goes into, it's actually like a really condensed, nice, tight paper, right? Like there wasn't a lot of like deep accuracy stuff that we need to skip over. But I think I want to, like, if y'all are down, I want to focus just on that challenge of the limits to predictability and talk just a little bit about maybe their scientific method to show that, because it's not super obvious. Like when I just saw the headline on some post somewhere, I was like, how does that work? How are you proving that with GraphCast? Like, it doesn't really make sense to me. So I think it is interesting to say like this is how they are showing that. It's not that they made predictions that are accurate out further into the future. They're just proving that it's possible, which is cool.
Yeah. And I actually think we should definitely get into this. There are some, in my spicy opinion, they have not yet proved it that it's possible, but has like cracked open this door and said like, hey, this really could be. And there's some decent evidence here. But this is also a really tricky, there's a lot of like, well, maybe it could be become because of this or this or this that you have to rule out to get way in there. But yeah, I want to underscore a key point that, as Marshall mentioned, the top line headline, you could misconstrue this paper from a like quick reading or like a general purpose reading of GraphCast. Somebody made GraphCast make 35 day forecasts that are accurate. That is actually not what is going on here. What they are doing is testing the limits of what is theoretically possible in terms of accuracy of how far in the future we could go, not producing something that actually could do it. But that's important because that base now shifts the bar out. So now there's more room and could motivate more hunger for people making actual operational forecasts to say, let's keep trying to get further and further and further, because like, we don't think that we're actually like a day or two away from the end. Like, we got two more weeks we could go, for instance, yeah. Which is exciting.
So maybe let's talk about how they did that. I think that piece is interesting and not totally obvious. So, you know, when you're using, maybe just to start from the beginning and interrupt me with questions or clarifications, y'all. When you're using like a GraphCast to make a forecast, you're taking some initial conditions of the Earth at probably different atmospheric levels. In the general kind of like AI weather model sense, and you're flowing it through usually a neural network or some kind of model, and then you're getting your prediction of a bunch of different variables, across space, across time, across different atmospheric elevations. And the problem, and this goes back to kind of the butterfly effect and that stuff I was talking about with Poincaré, I really hope I'm saying that name right, is that the initial conditions are imperfect. You know, cue the Era 5 air horn. Bow, 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 bow. We're going to do that every, you know, Era 5. Powerful, but, you know, so so overused or so tired. You know, it's just like it's everywhere. Can't be a weather hipster in this world with Era 5 around because you just got to use it. But Era 5 is incredible, but it's imperfect. And so if you're using that or using, you know, some other initial conditions, the point is that we don't have a perfect view of what conditions are everywhere. And that drift, the drift between actual and whatever you're telling the model, hey, this is what I think initial conditions are, that's the source of the greatest errors, especially as you propagate further into the future, as we learned from Poincaré. So what they did, you could think of it as like a flow, the flow of a river, right? Normally the river is flowing downstream and you're going from initial conditions through the model to a forecast. They reverse the flow of the river and back propagated the error to the initial conditions to try to correct them to something that gave a more optimal forecast. And so there are problems with that, and they do a good job addressing some of those problems because it's not necessarily correcting the initial conditions to what actually was there. It's correcting the initial conditions to what produces a better forecast, a more skillful forecast. But I thought that was really cool. And they specifically picked a kind of like GraphCast light version. And I love every time GraphCast is cited, LAM, I'm like, LAM, that's so familiar. And I remember that I used to rock climb with Remy, who I think is the first out there. Remy, if you're out there, you know, I hope you're still rock climbing. You know, hope you're still hanging out with Bertrand, our climbing buddy. Anyway, and please return my phone calls. yeah. Last thing I'll say, and then I'll pause for a little bit, is that we talked about the using the Panju weather model, the secondary one, and the reason for that was to basically do this process of the GraphCast to correct the initial conditions and then use those initial conditions on a model with a different enough architecture to see, like, do things still improve? And if they do, that tells us that we're not just overfitting for kind of what GraphCast does. We're actually producing initial conditions that in a more isolated way make forecast skill greater, right? So that took me a couple, like I had to read through that a couple times, but that it's cool. It's a cool method and it's simple. Yeah. It's a simple way to do this.
I think that's some definitely like helpful clarification for my understanding of this paper, Marsh. And I think like one of my foundational questions, and curious if you all have answers to this, but I guess like from a theoretical sense, like this idea that the initial conditions are going to affect the accuracy output, to me, it feels like I don't want to say obvious, but something in hindsight that just feels so truthful, that it maybe appears to be obvious once you see that it's true. And so I guess one of my questions is like, how have we come to this now? Because I think theoretically that makes total sense. Like the initial conditions impact the output in that way. And so is the answer then like the computational power that we have to like go back and I guess it's back propagation. I have no idea what that means, but I think that's my question of like, what are the conditions that like help us understand this now?
Fabulous question. So the errors that we're getting in our weather forecasts, you can kind of think of them as coming from a couple different buckets. And you can bucket this in a multiple ways. But one is that, you know, we've got a model and it's an imperfect model of what the actual physics going on. So that's going to introduce some problems. These models also have initial conditions. So if those are wrong, those are then going to propagate through and create another source of errors. And then finally, we've got the chaotic nature of the atmosphere, which is basically the final other factor that's really tricky, where things might just happen randomly and then snowball that makes things also even more hard to predict. And the question is, you know, how much that one of the ways to think about the question this paper is asking is there more juice to be squeezed out of improving those initial conditions, and at what point does the errors that are introduced from the randomness and the chaos in the atmosphere make it so that even if you had perfect initial conditions, you still couldn't get a useful forecast beyond some certain number of days. So what is new about this is that basically one of the things that's new about this is figuring out a way to go get at initial conditions that are as close as perfect as possible to isolate the errors coming from that chaos aspect of things and help push us out to say, like, if we were to make this initial conditions piece of things perfect, if we were to somehow like get sensors all over the atmosphere and just totally solve that, then still how much would chaos get throw in the way and cause a challenge and make us not be able to get to the end here? The other piece that is new and is that this is possible, that flowing back up the river that Marshall was describing, the back propagation or gradient-based methods, because this weather model is implemented as a deep neural network. And deep neural networks are built in these frameworks that have what's called automatic differentiation, and that's necessary to actually train them. So this is like the core machinery inside the code that makes it so that when you get an error in your prediction, you can work back through the model during the model training process and then go adjust the weights, so the strengths of the different connections in your neural network. You can go adjust those to make a better prediction next time. And that's the training process of a neural network. You put in a sample, you see how wrong you were, you flow back up, you adjust the weights, and then you go forward and keep doing that until your errors get to some nice, hopefully not too large point. The brilliant piece of this was saying, we can actually take that flowing through process, and instead of having it go and change the strength of the connections inside the neural network, instead, we can take a neural network that's already been trained as a good quality weather model, and we can flow back from those forecast errors to not the strength of the connections, but the initial conditions, and bump those and adjust those so that we would produce a forecast with less error when you go all the way, 10 and 14 days through. So this is the thing that honestly got me the most excited about this paper and the early versions of the kind of the foreshadowing work that they did with it. Just looking at the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest, was this is like an actually new thing where people are looking at what we can do with AI weather models and seeing like, this is a brand new capability that we did not have with other weather models. And we can now just like, not just use that to try to make like X amount better accuracy, but like ask these new questions and like try to answer these new questions we've never been able to answer before.
I'm a little, so like the main critique I have of what you said leads to is, it's nice that they used a second machine learning model. You really need a second like representation of the initial conditions, right? To like have ERA 5 on both sides, you are getting better at predicting something that you are implicitly saying is not perfect, right? Like, so there's something there that I can't fully articulate, but gives me some discomfort. But I do think the exciting thing, and this is something we've talked a lot about, is that there's so much untapped data out there, whether it's stuff being captured on airplanes at high altitudes or, just stuff that's just hard to gather, like data that's hard to gather, observations that are difficult to gather, that I'm excited to see how we can incorporate them into ERA 6, ERA 6, or a secondary one. I think the thing this is maybe just like meta commentary, I'm a little worried, especially with all the funding cuts, like it would be really nice to have lots of ERA 5 equivalents, because it just gives us a little bit more diversity in the kind of error that might be presented in the initial conditions and in what we're measuring our models against. Anyway.
Yeah.
Marsh, I'm curious if you say that because you feel like, you know, that would help us like, get closer to our understanding of how accurate the models are. Because I think that my understanding of this is that it helps us to see the models are working the way we want them to out to this certain point. And then if you introduce these other like multiple iterations of the initial conditions, like you said, is it that you'd want to see the model look at something that's harder to predict?
I think that's a part of it. It's cool that we kind of have this. We've all collectively agreed like, all right, that's the goalpost, you know, train on that, evaluate on that. Great. Cause it makes it very easy to compare all of these papers because everyone's just saying, how accurate are you compared to ERA 5? But the thing that I'm afraid of is implicitly in this paper, they are saying ERA 5 is imperfect, right? It is not a perfect thing to use as your initial conditions. It is maybe one of the things that's limiting us to predictability out of 14 days. It's an incredible, you know, data set, body of work, but there's just this discomfort of the homogenous usage of it. And it's because there's nothing else as good as it, right? But if we had more of them, just like it's really nice to have so many. Suddenly, we have tons of different AI weather models that are trying different things. You know, we talked about the parsimonious one in another episode. You just have this like kind of like diversity. And there are definitely many ways to get reanalysis, but people just don't seem to see the value in using anything but ERA 5 in the kind of like AI wave we're in right now. Anyway, I don't know what I'm really talking about. It's just that much homogeneity when we say accurate. Like, again, I'm going to go off for one more second. I'm so sorry. I've actually heard this in conversations with folks in the industry where they're like, oh yeah, accurate compared to ERA 5. But like, what about my rain gauges? Like, how accurate is it compared to those? It's, you know, back to mistrust of weather forecasts in Appalachia, right? Are people going to mistrust some of this because it is just compared to ERA 5 and we need more that like takes it all the way back to end models? Is there a way to do good end to end that starts from observations and ends with in situ measurements as well? Like that will be that something that's interesting. It's just hard.
We're going to dynamical.org. We're going to make some more analyses. There are some great ones from NASA and others that are, been talking to some researchers in India who make a cool one just covering the India and surrounding area. We can make more of these good analyses available. I definitely agree on that. Like that's one of the kind of open questions here that keeps this from being like, you have proved the theoretical limit has been extended to you have opened the door to, and at least in my opinion, is like the, you know, it would be really great to see that the updated and improved initial states better matched like an entirely different data set that we think is closer to the like truth out there. But when we're kind of like training the model on one data set, using that data set as truth in the future, and then working back to adjust it, it's like, there's a chance we're all just like over here talking about this like imaginary version of the world and like the real world's over here. And maybe we haven't actually shown what we hope. Yeah.
Yeah. I do believe though that with any chaotic system, chaos just means it's hard to model. And that if we did, like, I'll just like jump to my like conclusion after, you know, reading early 20th century mathematical treatises. we can model anything if you have enough information about it. Like, I do believe that. I don't think that there's, like, the challenge is how do we get better initial conditions? And I just feel like there is nothing has convinced me that it is impossible to model that. You just have to go deeper. Like, if you're like, oh, but what about like quantum mechanics? It's like, well, just model that. It's just like, it's like, how far do you want to go? I'm wearing my science hat right now, and I have like another hat that maybe doesn't believe in this, but like, there are very few things that are random, if any. So if randomness isn't in play, then you really can model just about anything. Of course, you know, once you take into account the human soul, not just kidding.
Well, I do think that this gets at like the philosophical question or tension that I think this paper has brought up in me. I don't know if this paper asks this question like outright. I think it gestures toward it. But I think what I'm wondering about, like, does this not prove but gesture toward the world, the atmosphere, you know, whatever, being less chaotic or more predictable? And how are those things different? And I think that it gestures toward it being more predictable, but not less chaotic.
I think that's right. But I guess what I was maybe tossing out there is like, chaos is a perception of difficulty to model. Like, right. Like a definite, you could maybe define, I'm going to make my own definition of chaos, which is that something is more chaotic when small changes in the initial conditions result in bigger changes in the final result. Like, that is chaos. And so if that is the case, it is proving it is both more predictable and less chaotic.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's challenging what we perceive as chaos and like how we go on to use that word. Because I do think implicitly that means like something beyond our grasp. That's one of my greatest tensions in this. But I'll say, like, I think that I want to retain as much of the, like, wonder in it as I can. And I do think that chaos helps us do that, like, if we perceive something as chaotic. But to me, that is incredible if something can be both chaotic and predictable. That feels like the place in, like, climate science generally that I want to, like, exist in, like, to that level of understanding while retaining that level too of maybe like reverence of the system itself being so vastly complicated.
Yeah. As we started doing hydrology work in Europe and learning more about like how manicured, I don't know a better word, how like controlled the river systems are, there's the pervasive desire among humanity to control nature, right? And I think if we could forecast weather out perfectly, it gives me this little feeling of we're controlling weather now. It is at our whim if we can really like look out 30, 60, 90 days and know exactly what's going to happen. It's like kind of strange. So yeah, I agree with that.
Well, I think, you know, what's interesting to me is like there is that impulse, I think, especially in Western science to predict the future in this effort to control. And I think that, you know, that part of us, though, that wants to predict the future, I think is maybe on that human level, because it's both the scientist part of us as well as like the mystic part of us. And yeah, I think like we probably need to be able to like hold both of those things together, because that impulse one way is completely like ascientific or anti-science. The other side of that impulse is an exorbitant amount of control with, you know, yeah, negative consequences as well.
I hold some hope for me to Marta's. Is it possible for us to hold both of these things?
Yeah. Well, I think like, you know, I'll say that, you know, the part of me that feels cautious is a marginal part. And I also like say these things maybe a little bit flippantly, but there is some truth in it. And I think the part of me that feels cautious is when I consider folks who don't have those close embodied experiences with nature that often. And if you have that sort of like intellectual understanding, sort of moving through the world, that we understand weather systems, out to 30 days, we have it, you know, it sort of intellectually becomes less unpredictable. So I think maybe that breeds some sort of irreverence, or like you just feel more in control of the world. But yeah, for every embodied experience you have, you know, with a strong storm or watching, you know, the Northern Lights, I mean, that's something that goes beyond like your intellectual understanding of how we predict. Like that's something you sense and feel. And I think that's always going to be part of like humanity. And so I think that's, yeah, that's totally important to say, Alden. Yeah.
All right. So should we critique this paper and say why we actually don't need, in the short term, need to worry about this, because chaos will continue to reign supreme?
Yeah.
Well, I have a quick question. They say they only went out to 32 days because of memory constraints. What does that mean? Like, like constraints in what? Like a single big juicy card? Like you can't get more memory to, like, I feel like the paper would have hit extra hard if it went out to 64 days. Is it a question of like, you know, calling up NVIDIA and being like, please, can we have one more juicy card?
Or even like a juicier card, not more than one of them. So it gets a little hard in like the mechanics of to actually split a model across multiple of these things. So like what would really be like the easy one is like, oh, I have, you know, 64 gigabytes of memory on this one. Can I just get the one that's got 200 or 128? And then you can go twice as far.
More modern definition of chaos is when something doesn't fit on a single GPU's memory, and that problem is really hard to model in some sort of horizontal scalable way.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
basically, in order to do that, you know, flowing back through, you have to remember all of these intermediate states.
I know. I was just disappointed that it didn't dig in there a little bit more, and it just says like, can't do it.
But it did sound like they went out to 45 days and saw like much less accuracy. So my understanding, and maybe this is not the right understanding, and memory is like is much more of a hurdle, but that maybe the limit right now is between that 32 day and 45 day mark. But we're feeling confident about the 32 day.
But basically they couldn't they could continue to run the model forward beyond that 32, but they stopped at basically, they stopped the looking at the errors and like flowing those back to the initial states at 32 days, because that part is really memory intensive, because you have to remember all of your intermediate states as you go back. Now there actually are some, like, this is way getting into the weeds, but there are some techniques that if you're willing to spend some more cycles computing on your GPU, you can reduce your memory. That would be fun to throw into this and see how far you could let it run.
Yeah. The other piece that I have underlined is around something we talked about earlier, which is with your book recommendation, just the regional weaknesses of the initial conditions. I thought that was super super interesting, and I think we could talk about that for like a whole episode, but it's just like, where do you go from here? Right. Because it's like, okay, we know we have maybe weak observations assimilated into the initial conditions of ERA5 in these regions. And it does feel overreaching to be like, all right, let's install some gauges. Let's fly some balloons. Let's get some, you know, but at the same time, the flip side of that is like, we want equity in forecast skill. And I'm trying to remember, I think it's, is it TerraWatch Space, the newsletter that Yeah, great, great newsletter. Check it out if you haven't. They had a whole series a while ago, maybe 8 months, a year ago, that was about like equity and weather forecasting. And I think that is a big question. You know, as we look at improving initial conditions, the next question is going to be, okay, how do we get better ground truth? Where are we getting data? Like, what are the methods for collecting that data? Where are the places that we have gaps in our data? So I think it's going to be a pretty hot topic coming out of this and coming out of a lot of like the machine learning model movement in weather forecasting, especially with the end-to-end models that like need more of the end-to-end, not, can't just use this, you know, assimilated reanalysis.
One thing actually, you know, as I'm looking at the figures here, which are some nice figures, they plot on a map the average changes that this process has learned to adjust different weather variables on spatially. So you could basically, you know, some of the main patterns are around the equator, where they've strengthened these atmospheric processes that are bringing up warm air at the equator, moving toward the poles and coming back down. But something that I think is one of the cool and like promising strong points that comes out of this is as they, to quote them down on page 3, the sample mean optimal perturbations reveal coherent large-scale structure with the greatest amplitude in the tropics and subtropics. But particularly like the coherent large-scale structure piece is that's a good sign that like what these adjustments that are being learned are not just like little fluky things that you just kind of fiddle with and they don't represent some real difference out in the real world. Like the changes that this process is suggesting in the initial conditions, like when an atmospheric scientist goes and looks at them, they say like, oh, that looks like a strengthening of the Hadley cycle, which is a cool, that's a big point one in the category of like, these are not just living in like made up land. This might be talking about some real improvements out in the world.
Right. Is that connected or like, is that where there's a section where they talk about preemptively trying to address criticisms of the paper and their method, but there's a suggestion that like maybe these tweaking like of the initial conditions is some sort of like adversarial hack to like trick the model or something. I was also curious, is that something that is like happening a lot or something that we're seeing like with like research in like large language models? And yeah,
it's definitely an area. I think I've seen the most work in this in image classification models. Like if you want to drive a car and somebody's using something to like scan camera scans, like is there a way that you can like paint your car so that it doesn't look like a car to this model? And there, you know, in many models that were not trained to be like resilient to this, there completely is. There are, and you can like find them. They're easier to do on one static picture that you can sit there and twiddle pixels on than a car that's driving down the road. Quite a bit easier to do. So these are definitely real things, and I think the reality is like to actually take advantage of them in the real world is tricky. But you're right, that was definitely like they're anticipating that question of like we know that some neural network models are susceptible to this. Are you just like, you know, finding these little not real weather pattern changes, just little tweaks that happen to fit the model better, not like a better understanding of the atmosphere?
One thing that did jump out at me, so I kind of have a perspective of this, like I don't know, Marshall's law of sleight of hand or something, where you can fiddle with any of these kinds of models and like get better results if you look at the right results, like if you cherry pick results. I don't think that's what's happening here, but I was kind of disappointed by the Penghu weather results. Like, it shows a good reduction of error in a very short term, but it actually, the error increases past 15 days. Right? Am I reading that right? The mean, yeah. If you just take the mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Which doesn't make, like...
Or it basically flatlines. I would say that's, you know, depending on...
flatlines.
You've returned to these adjustments and not having an improvement.
And it addresses that, but it just feels like that kind of is a counterpoint to the argument where... Yeah, you got short-term improvements, but you're not with your kind of your secondary check. You didn't get anything out past the current limits of predictability. So I want to see more there. Like, why should we try more models to make sure that it isn't a limitation of Penghu weather? Like, that left me. Like, again, I feel like, yeah, I agree with the paper's conclusion that we can forecast as far as we want with enough precision of the initial conditions and a good enough model. But that just made it hit less hard. If it showed a reduction in error also out past that limit, I would have been like, ooh, yeah, nice, cool. But it doesn't.
And then just to even to pile on top of that, it is true that Penghu weather is a different neural network structure. However, to come back to our era 5 homogeneity, it was trained on the same era 5 weather data set.
Yeah.
So if we've been kind of a big takeaway from actually using neural networks in practice is that you can use a bunch of different architectures of the actual model inside, and it's what they end up learning is really far more driven by the data that goes into them, assuming the model's, like, you know, roughly capable of doing the same types of things. So to me, these models are actually relatively similar, which kind of pulls off of the strength of the move it to another model result even more. Like, what would be you know, impressive is, like, oh, you go take these initial conditions and you go put them in, like, ECMWF's IFS model or NOAA's, like, dynamical GFS model, and then see an improvement there. And, like, that would be a very convincing and also, you know, much harder to do in a paper result.
Why has ERA 5 or ERA 5 like become the standard?
It is accessible, clean, and while people may like to hate on its quality, in general, better than the alternatives that are global and also accessible and long history. So, like, you know, while it has its problems, it's also in many ways, if you combine all of the different things you care about a data set, the best thing out there. But there's really, we really should be using more at the same time. Like, and there are some cool papers that we can talk about in the future that are doing that.
Can we transition to closing thoughts? Alton, you first.
Sure. Maybe one other thing, one other point for this, the supporting point that I think is a interesting and good thing to see is they looked at the correlation between the adjustments that were made to an initial state for one forecast and then, like, the forecast 12 hours later and the forecast 12 hours later and the forecast 12 hours later after that. And there is correlation. There's, you know, there are, for some of the variables, it's like, you know, around 0.4 one day ahead. So that's just like one more point in this isn't learning fluky, weird little, just like fiddles that make the answer better. Like if the adjustments it gets to the next day are very correlated with the adjustments it made to the state the previous day, that's a good sign that like these adjustments are consistent things that are actually can help the forecast. So I was happy to see that autocorrelation versus lag plot on page 4. That's a cool one.
I think my closing thoughts are pretty like 1,000-foot view, I have to say. But I think like the thing that just like strikes me the most is just I feel like every day I'm learning about a new way in which AI is being applied to something like I just never would have imagined it being applied to. And I think this comes from too like my perspective of like not having deeply thought about artificial intelligence until maybe like 2 years ago, and ChatGPT like scared all the writers so much that we then had to start thinking about it. But yeah, I think that, you know, that like question of like what now do I understand more of about like the atmosphere? Is it more predictable, less chaotic? Like I think that thinking through those things has been just like very, very fascinating to me. And just every day I think I'm continually like going deeper into the question of like where do I fall on kind of thinking about AI? What are my thoughts on it? And I think that this is like pushing me in a maybe more positive light too. And like I was reading recently too about like a like machine learning model that was initially created for financial markets, like was ended up being applied to like animal behaviors, and like AI is really, really good at helping us understand like the languages that animals use. And yeah, I think that, you know, these sorts of like vast applications are very exciting to me. And that idea that maybe we could predict the weather 30 days out, even if there's a part of me that's concerned about it, ultimately feel pretty, pretty excited by that. That's where I come down on it.
I will close with the pitch I will make every episode that with sufficient initial conditions and a really good picture of the sun, we should be good to go. Yeah. But I'll read since I started with Poincaré, I'll end with like a little tidbit that I thought is good. Nothing that has been said so far explains why chance is obedient to laws. Is the fact that the causes are small or that they are complex sufficient to enable us to predict, if not what the effects will be in each case, at least what they will be on the average? And he goes on, I think this is a really good analogy, to talk about roulette, which I imagine was just like the game to play in 1903. And he says like, yeah, we think of these games as chance, right? But if I know exactly the impulse given to it, I can tell you, and where the ball starts, I can tell you what it will land on. So I think that's like a really good reduction of this kind of idea of chaos and chance and the limits of predictability. It really comes down to our ability to understand it, to kind of model the universe. And the final kind of sentence fragment I'll leave us with from, and I'm quoting again, our frailty does not permit us to take in the whole universe, but forces us to cut it up in slices. That's pretty good.
Wow, that's amazing.